Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I'm John Hume and I am the editor of the Investors Chronicle. I am joined this week by Companies Editor Stephen Wilmot. How are you doing, Stephen?
Yeah, good, John. Thanks.
Excellent. Busy week this week.
Has been, yeah.
Yeah, good.
Third quarter results season.
Good. Like to see you all working hard over there in the company's desk. Emma Powell, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
And you've written the cover feature this week, which we're going to talk about, outsourcing.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, carve up,
the
country's public services, which we don't condone necessarily, but if it's going to happen, we might as well make the most of it. And Bradley, Gerard, how are you, Bradley?
I'm fantastic, thanks, John.
Let's start with 7 days, our roundup of the big events of the week. Obviously, the biggest news of the week was last Friday's terrorist atrocities in Paris, which obviously pretty shocking. And we obviously have great sympathy for anyone involved in that. The market seems to take it in their stride.
Yeah, I mean, there were some travel-related stocks took an inevitable short-term hit, but I mean, I think that's expected. I mean, the market as a whole, I think, kind of dipped a little bit because it does tend to when these things happen, but it has recovered. But obviously, that's a moot point given what happened in Paris, as you say, very tragic events.
Indeed, and yeah, I mean, just looking at the FTSE 30-day rolling price that we publish on the stats page, I mean, the shares are up this week. It's been a pretty strong week, and that's despite the backdrop of a rate rise potentially over in the US. The Fed is obviously published the minutes this week, and I think people are bracing themselves for a rise in December now.
Yeah, closely watched as ever, any words that are uttered by the Federal Open Markets Committee over in the US. People are keen to know what they're going to do, and obviously they don't sort of really tell you in advance. They just kind of make statements which are picked apart by thousands and thousands of people. And yeah, it does seem now, I mean, we've been here before and we've probably heard it before as well, but it does seem now that December could be the month where rates finally lift off in the US. But, you know, that various factors have been blamed for not moving rates before, and we've got another few weeks. So if there's some more weak data out of Europe or China, or Japan's back in recession now, a technical recession, arguably. But, you know, there are potential reasons why December might not happen.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to give themselves a bit of wiggle room in their thinking. So yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they postpone it again.
No, it's just sensible, I guess. I mean, yeah. And I guess, I mean, linked to that is talking about 7 days, obviously, an interesting thing is Germany. It's not the first time they've done it, but they've got 2-year debt away and negative yield. So that potentially speaks to, you know, sort of bearishness, arguably, in the global investor community, because if you would effectively pay Germany to give them some money, then you can't be that confident about things. So.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, I take a very gloomy tone in my editorial, not just because of the tragic events in Paris, but because I am genuinely concerned, as we spoke about last week, about some of the signs we're seeing from global trade. You know, we're seeing a lot of profit warnings. We're going to talk about those very shortly.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think safe havens are becoming sought after all the more at the
moment. Well, you just have to look at that, yeah. I guess then in other areas of 7 days, a very interesting story which perhaps helps that FTSE figure that you mentioned a bit earlier is Smith's group, which I think on the day the shares rose about 10% if I remember rightly. Effectively what they announced was the fact that they would be able to put a bit less contribution into their pension scheme, which will free up some free cash flow. And there's also the suggestion that what this will also enable it to do is sell off parts of its business. We actually had Smith on a sell, I think, as a sell tip. And part of the reason was because we were saying it needs to sell off parts of its business and it can't. And then shortly after, obviously, now it's been able to do that. So I think Daniel Liberto, who covers that company for us, one of our specialist writers, is looking at that again, and we'll be publishing an updated tip, I think, based on this significant change.
I mean, one thing that Smith makes is explosive detection machines that are used at airports and border controls, and I guess that's kind of a good place to be now.
Yeah,
when you look at the response to what's happened in Paris and what's happening elsewhere in the world, yeah, borders look like they're going to be tightened up.
Absolutely, yeah. Everywhere you look, I mean, just listening to the news, you've got obviously France is borders are still shut for the moment. Germany still seems fairly open and relaxed, but yeah, I think you're right. The sort of the direction of travel would more likely be, if we see another atrocity as well, would be that borders are going to become much tighter.
Yeah, and by all accounts, there's plots being prevented left, right, and centre at the moment.
Yeah,
it's not good at all. Asset managers. Let's move on to that quickly because the FCA has has them in its crosshairs.
It does. I mean, arguably it always does, but particularly now it's published its expected terms of reference market study. It's an interesting one, I suppose. Obviously, we've got Martin Wheatley recently departed from the FCA. There's a new sort of head of the regulator now. And so I guess it's kind of it's going to want to make sure that it looks like it's doing what it's supposed to be doing where asset managers are concerned. It's going to be it's going to want to show that it's still on top of issues within the asset management sector.
Well, what's it worried about in the asset management sector?
I think
fees, pay.
Yeah, well, the usual
thing. Or
the lot. Yeah, the lot. And I mean, competition as well. I mean, Hargreaves Lansdown put out a note and they were saying that the amount of money in ISAs that are sold by fund groups in which you can only invest in that fund group's products, that has only just fallen below the level of money in ISAs on platforms where you can choose from, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of funds. So there's that inertia that I think the regulator is worried about. And what that inertia tends to mean is that there is a lot of money sitting in underperforming funds. And also consumers aren't actually, you know, taking advantage of the choice that is available to them if they just move platform.
I mean, my view on that would be that many, many consumers, many members of the buying public, they're not especially well informed. I mean, there's a lot of information out there, but people, this is something that scares them, investing. And,
yeah,
you know, they would perhaps perceive a safe haven brand that they've heard of. You know, I won't name any names, but there's a lot of big fund management groups that are very well known.
Yeah.
And, you know, those safe haven brands might appeal to people who are a bit reticent about investing.
And arguably, you could say that there are some fund groups who maybe you might, even if you had the choice of the whole market, you might end up choosing quite a few of their funds. So if you're in their ISA, it might not be a bad thing. And you might be able to have a mixture of investment trusts and funds with that one funds group. But as you say, pensions are a daunting prospect. We're as a population, I think in the UK, probably a bit underinformed, or maybe we're just not reading the amount of information that is out there. Depends on your point of view, I suppose. But
I think there's a lot of information out there.
Yeah.
I think if you picked up the Investors Chronicle each week, you would be able to definitely separate the wheat from the chaff. I mean, it's something we do in the fund section a lot. I don't know why there is this tendency to just go for, you know, the comfort of a brand and pay no attention to the fees and the performance. It's slightly bizarre.
It is bizarre. And I guess this is exactly one of the things that the FCA will certainly be hoping to look at and raise awareness of. As you say, obviously, us here at the Investors Chronicle, we try our best to make sure people know, what they're investing in and make them try and get them to think about why they're investing in the things that they are. And so, you know, the FCA will be keen to, echo that, I suppose.
Okay, well, you know where we are. Happy to help out.
Always.
Another story here about Playtech and Plus 500, which is a potential merger in the gambling sector, which has been a hotbed of corporate activity at the moment. But there's some other activity going on there at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think a really interesting story is the letter by a chap called Dermot Desmond, who basically sent a letter to the shareholders of Ladbrokes outlining his displeasure about the mooted deal with Gala Coral. Dermot Desmond is not the largest shareholder. I think he owns about 1% stake. But the interesting thing about him is that he's very well known. He's high profile.
Yeah, he had something to do with an attempt to take over of Manchester United a few years back.
If you look at the Wikipedia page on him, he has a very, very interesting history in terms of his business life. I mean, he set up a stockbroker, National City Brokers in Dublin in 1981. He's purchased and sold years ago the London City Airport. He's had a lot of different business interests. Now he runs a private equity firm. And he actually sold his BetDAC exchange to Ladbrokes, so he does know the business pretty well.
Should we be worried that this is going to derail the deal?
Well, very interestingly, the timing is intriguing because the EGM for Ladbrokes is on Tuesday. So just in a few days' time, the shareholders will vote on whether the merger between Ladbrokes and Gala Coral should go ahead. So the timing of this is very interesting. Not only that, but one of the fund managers that I spoke to who works for a fund management group that's within the top 10 shareholders of Ladbrokes said to me that Dermot Desmond had been trying to meet as many shareholders as possible and that he would be trying to meet Mr. Desmond as well before the meeting to at least hear what he's got to say. So it seems like Mr. Desmond is certainly keen to try and get his views heard, and he's doing his best to get in front of as many investors as he can.
And why not? I mean, you know, Ladbrokes has had a torrid run of things over the last few years. I mean, you can't imagine there's many people thinking, holding out for some kind of, you know,
Yeah, I mean, it's had a tough
great,
time.
Better, you know, improved performance without something significant like a merger with another player. Actually
exactly.
Happening.
It's had a tough time. And the people that I've spoken to kind of say, we accept what he's saying. You know, there are issues such as if Ladbrokes has to sell an awful lot of shops, the amount of profits it might lose from that might well outweigh any synergies that can be found with the merged entity. But at the same time, his only really kind of solution seems to be hire an investment bank to assess the options, which, let's face it, normally means sell. Yeah. But if you sell, who's the buyer? I mean, you know, William Hill has a massive estate, so that wouldn't merge very well with Ladbrokes. It's difficult to see who else, given the fervent M&A landscape in the gambling sector, who else would come along. So maybe this is... I mean, the fund manager that I spoke to said this was an okay deal. He viewed it as okay. It wasn't a standout deal, but he acknowledges that scale is going to be so important in this industry going forward, given things like the point of consumption tax, which is tax on offshore companies, is, you know, UK profits, and machine gaming duty. So scale is going to be key, and this merger does give... Ladbrokes that.
Yeah. I mean, the only other player I can think of that might be interested is Paddy Power, but they're obviously in the midst of a big deal with themselves.
Exactly. So, this is the thing. They're in the midst of a deal with Betfair, as you say, and then you've also got GVC, who is looking to take over Bwin. So you could argue 888 might be interested, because 888 got beaten to the punch for Bwin. GVC outbid it. So maybe 888 might look to do that, but there wasn't the suggestion I got from the analysts and the managers that I spoke to yesterday.
No. Anyway, certainly a lot of corporate activity going on in that sector.
Absolutely, yeah.
Interesting, always interesting, that sector, even if it's unsavoury. But that's just my opinion. Okay, what else we got? DX, I mean, that was a horror show.
Yeah, there was a profit warning that came out. I think it was about midday on Friday. So it kind of...
12 o'clock Friday 13th.
Yeah, exactly.
Not a good time to do a profit warning.
No, obviously normally these announcements come sort of earlier in the morning so that people who check the RNS announcements kind of see that sort of thing. But, I mean, it came out in the middle of the day. The shares plunged some 70% from about 80p to 24.
I mean, I think there is a small cadre of management and PR advisors that think that you can sneak out a profit warning. here is the reason for never try and sneak out a profit warning. DX.
No, I'm sure. I hope that they weren't thinking that they were to sort of avoid any notice by doing it. But I guess one thing it points to, which is. You know, which is kind of interesting, is the fact that if you miss expectations these days, the market does punish you. It really does punish you.
Yeah, because we talked about this last week. Rolls-Royce got punished. I mean, yeah, that's a big company, but even, you know, 20% profit warning for a company like that is pretty substantial.
It is, yeah.
And I write in my editorial this week, you know, the interesting thing, and this was an observation made by a very successful investor I had lunch with last week, was, there seems to be an elevated level of profit warnings, but the reaction to them seems to be worsening.
Yeah.
The reactions are quite severe, and 70% for a profit warning is, I mean, it's massive.
Yeah, it's huge. And I mean, I think, you know, that it's not going to, I don't think it's going to fall into a loss or anything. I mean, it's not going to do as well as it hoped it would. And I mean, I guess there's an argument that the industry it's operating in is very competitive, so there is that issue as well. And I guess if you're not going to meet your expectations, then that's quite foreboding in that sector. But as you say, the reaction to these things is becoming very, very big, very sort of the share price movement on one day, I mean, that is just remarkable.
Indeed. And actually what this guy said to me was that, you know, not only that, you're seeing a lot of companies who are just about staving off having to warn by saying we're going to make it up in the second half. And I noticed a number of those in the results section this week.
Yeah, absolutely. We've had...
There's one for electro components, which I'm writing about today, actually.
And that's what they've said.
Going to make it up in the second half.
Yeah, I mean, this guy's view is, well, you know, any deterioration in the economic backdrop means that anyone promising to make up in the second half is, optimistic. And his view, I mean, he runs portfolios that he promotes publicly. You can see what he's doing, and he's saying anyone who says they're making it up in the second half, sell it. What are we saying about electric components?
They want to sell.
So while we're on the subject of results, Stephen, what we got this week?
Well, it's the beginning.
Mixed bag.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're sort of in the throes of the third quarter results season. Mostly companies that have year ends which coincide with the fiscal year, so they end in May, in March, they have their half year results at this time of year,
Yeah, this is the results season we always forget about. It creeps up on us. It's like, oh, God.
But, yeah, no, it has been interesting. And I mean, actually, there have been a lot of downgrades. Actually, there some analysis by Canaccord, which is the broker that took over Colin Stewart's Quest equity analysis business.
Anyway. Yeah, they've got a big, interesting sort of proprietary data tool.
Yeah, exactly.
And a lot of their research.
And they put out some interesting information talking about earnings downgrades and how it's not just energy and materials.
Mm.
So it's not just, you know, BP and Shell and BHP. It's also, you know, it's been quite common in other sectors as well. Just looking at the FTSE 350.
See, I don't have a big proprietary data engine to tell me this, but my gut feel.
Yeah, no,
this is.
Yeah, there have been a lot
worsening.
There have been a lot of profit warnings, and so. As you know, often what you get, the pattern tends to be that earnings expectations are downgraded because analysts start the year quite optimistic and they kind of gradually downgrade their earnings.
It does work the other way as well, as algae talks about, but upgrade cycles. I guess it depends where you are in.
Yeah, as I say, that happened in 2010.
Cycle.
I don't think it's happened in a year since that. As far as I know, but what's a bit unusual at the moment is that people are downgrading their expectations for 2016 as well,
right?
Because you've got some very weak outlook statements.
Let's talk about EasyJet because you know, on paper these were absolutely spectacular.
Well, that's
fifth year of record.
It's a great example of investors obviously having ridiculously high expectations because they record profits, dividend up 20% or something like that, wasn't it, Bradley?
Yeah, I mean, it comes back to the point we were making earlier. I mean, they hit the midpoint of their guidance, which meant they achieved a fifth year of record profits, and the shares were down 4% on the day. I mean, maybe you could say it's profit taking. I mean, I don't know, but yeah, it was a very strange share price movement for that amount of for that performance from the airline.
Yeah. Yeah, no. I mean, it's an extraordinary fall for what are solid results, and I guess people are worried about what the next couple of years have in store.
Maybe there's a reaction as well to the recent tragic incidents in Sharm el Sheikh and Paris and that sort of thing. Just to travel generally, but maybe that's partly baked into that recent share price fall.
Well, I mean, EasyJet shares are down over the year. The calendar year, so I mean since the beginning, since January, their shares are down. I mean, and yet, you know, the tailwinds of low fuel prices and economic growth and economic recovery in Europe are with them. So there may be some sentiment behind that as well. And I write about this in my editorial. You know, TUI, which merged with its parent company this year, I mean, its booking trends are solid and its shares are going nowhere.
I think people are worried about the outlook and the cycle turning.
And I think people are worried about the geopolitical backdrop, certainly in the travel sector as well.
I was going to say, with EasyJet, could not some of it be, I don't know how much of an impact, but the whole terrorist attacks, not only Tunisia, but obviously most recently Paris, would that...
They did address this on the call, and the chief executive, Carolyn McCann, said that Sharm's only like 0.5% of all of their traffic. So it's not a significant amount, that route. But obviously that doesn't mean that will stop people wanting to fly anywhere, not just to Sharm el Sheikh or...
That's what I was saying. That's what I mean, that general feeling.
I don't know. People are funny. People are funny. I bumped into a friend at lunchtime, actually, and he said his wife won't get on a plane now. He said she struggles to get on a plane at the best of times, and now she's definitely not getting on a plane. So people do worry about this.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's very visible, and I mean, EasyJet is it's short haul. It doesn't, you know, but it does fly to some of these destinations that, like Tunisia or Egypt, that have been affected. So yeah, I mean, it probably is a worry. But yes, there you go.
Another interesting result was Punch. They announced their response to the government's move to abolish the beer tie. This has been long awaited. They had their debt problems obviously last year, and so that there's been this long recovery plan. But then this was another big long awaited announcement. Bradley, I mean, you wrote that one up.
Yeah. I mean, as you say, actually, interestingly, Punch and Enterprise Inns, which are the two companies most affected by the changes in legislation that are coming in, both reported in the past week. As Stephen said, they're both kind of having to make sure that their house is in order, so to speak, because the legislation will mean that pubs that the company owns will no longer have to buy drinks from the company and that sort of thing. So the MRO stands for market rent only. So you would just pay rent as a publican and you could buy your drinks from wherever you liked.
But what Punch is trying to do is sort of create a buyer's club anyway amongst the...
It's done, which
looks quite interesting.
That exists. And actually, really interestingly, I didn't really know this, but you can even get cheaper gas and electric through it. So there are quite big incentives for publicans to be part of these buyer's clubs because you get the economies of scale, not just on your sort of obvious things like beverages, but also your utility bills. So there are advantages to it.
They really will test, you know, they've always said, oh, well, publicans benefit, but this will be the test. You know, will they actually stick with the beer tie, you know, because of these economies of scale they're supposed to have access to, or will they decide that actually, no, they're better off getting their market rent?
Oh, I thought we'd given up on Punch altogether. But there you go. Okay.
Well, they both trade on... I mean, their shares are sort of trading on extremely cheap multiples because that reflects the fact that you've got weak beer volumes and very high levels of debt. So,
yeah, interesting. Interesting. Okay. So maybe they're going to come back into the investment spotlight again.
Yeah, well, I think what we conclude as a result of those two results were that, you know, these companies are now looking investable. We need a bit more evidence of actually organic growth, I think is the key one, isn't it?
Yeah, and also proof that these new models that they're going for are going to actually work and produce something. So
very early days, but they are looking like one could actually invest in them again.
Okay, interesting. And plenty more results in the magazine this week. So plenty of results there from the real estate sector, from the real estate investment trusts, and across the board, actually. I mean, it's been a busy week. Emma, you've written this week's cover feature. Let's talk about that now. So it's about outsourcing. Give us a bit of background. Why have we written this feature? What's it all about?
Basically, what we're saying is outsourcing is on the rise.
Outsourcing's on the rise. Why is that then?
Big government cuts, basically. About $20 billion, George Osborne announced. And what history has told us is that as money gets tight, outsourcing goes up.
And so basically what we're looking at in the piece is who's going to be the beneficiaries of that, which areas of services are going to be basically farmed out, what's up for grabs. Let's talk through perhaps, you know, the big areas that we expect to be put out to tender or that are already being run by private companies. Where are the sweet spots here for the private companies that we cover?
Big one would be kind of Ministry of Justice.
But
not just the traditional ones, because obviously we all know about G4S and Serco and how it has gone very wrong in the past, as well as Capita. They're a big one, but we're talking about people like even Interserve.
Okay.
They made an acquisition to the Employment and Skills Group. Bit out of the ordinary for them, actually, because that's training people to get back into work, but kind of ex-offenders, trying to skill them up. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
So a bit out of the ordinary, because usually, you know, they'll just do construction or cleaning services or things like that.
Can they do this? How are they actually, themselves getting the skills to actually provide this kind of service?
This is a comment from some analysts that have said, generally, stick to what you know with an acquisition. And this is very out of the ordinary for them. They've never made an acquisition in this kind of skills area. So I think... from people I spoke to, they say the jury's still out on whether this will be a good acquisition for them.
Yeah.
Still early days.
So a lot of M&A activity going on to help these companies kind of tap into the hot areas in government outsourcing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Another big one, Welfare to Work.
Welfare to Work, okay.
Bit of a controversial one, that one, obviously.
Well, it's all controversial.
It's all the whole debate over outsourcing is controversial. Kind of privatisation, some would say. Mm. Things like the NHS versus need to cut costs.
Yeah.
So it's all controversial.
Well, I mean, there is the big argument. I mean, before we get back onto Welfare to Work, that outsourcing is just a way of passing a problem onto the private sector, who will then just basically... downgrade the level of service they provide to the citizens of the country
in order
to make money.
Well, that is one argument.
do you believe that argument?
It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because obviously historically with Serco and people like that, one of the reasons from a company's perspective that they went so badly wrong is because they keep, everyone's trying to chase this pot of money, and so everyone's undercutting each other. This is a big kind of place where G4S and Serco went wrong. They're all trying, they're all bidding on these kind of tiny margins.
So they're underbidding, basically.
So they're all underbidding each other, trying to undercut each other. And then you've got to think to yourself, well, what standard of service are you going to deliver if you're just trying to undercut and undercut and undercut? And actually, Mighty is another one, actually, a recent sale tip of ours, of mine.
How's it going? Well, I would imagine.
Well, to be honest, they're actually doing all right at the moment.
Oh, well,
we're saying they're a long-term sell.
Yeah, okay? But this is on the basis that...
Well, no, this is on the basis of the fact that they keep bidding for contracts, sometimes getting the contracts and then ending up with exceptional costs that actually aren't acceptable, exceptional because they happen every single year, and it's things like they've had to make provisions for contracts that they couldn't complete and things like that. So they would be a really good example, actually, if people want to look at Mighty, look at their accounts, of a company that is, they were actually one of the big competitors for Serco.
Is Mighty the new Serco?
Well, what do you mean in terms of recovery?
I mean, Serco, obviously, we've actually got Serco on a buy now, right?
Yeah, that's
because they've been through this cycle of provisions and
they went right to the bottom, didn't they?
When I say is Mighty the new Serco, I mean, are they at that point where they're about to have to kind of write?
Well, this
off
is my massive, argument. Yeah. Yeah, this is my argument because they've already gotten into that pattern of having to have provisions for contracts. And organic growth really kind of slowing. Actually, we talk about them because they do a lot of care in the home as well.
Okay.
Compete with people like Mears. Care in the home is not doing well at the moment. Obviously, that's something that's outsourced by a lot of either kind of NHS trusts, it can be, or local authorities. And I know there's big recruitment issues there. And unsurprisingly, because it's kind of minimum wage and it's a tough job, as well as the fact that a lot of government departments are facing these big cuts and there's just not the budget for it. So I know Mears, they kind of do the social housing and the care in the home, but care in the home is just really lagging behind at the moment.
In terms of the business performance?
Business performance, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Okay, I mean, it's interesting. I know someone who receives care in the home from, as it turns out, an outsourced provider, pays for it themselves. The service is not great. It's not great. You know, you don't get a lot for your money, put it that way. So let's go back to Welfare to Work, because Staffline is the big
Staffline
company. We kind of like Staffline.
Staffline. If you got into Staffline before the election, I think it went from something like 800p to now it's on like 1500 and something pence.
Mm.
I actually wanted to tip it, but... I think it was too risky, our tips editor said, but just before the election. Fair dues.
Yes, the age-old argument with the tips editor.
Fair dues.
Yeah, all right. No, I've been there. Been there, don't worry.
But
it's always the tips editor's fault when it doesn't go our way.
It's our good spot when it does go.
The tips editor's fault are the ones that get left behind. Been there, don't worry.
But in terms of the Welfare to Work... That's very lucrative for anyone that doesn't know how it works. Basically, people that are long-term unemployed, the idea is to give them work experience to get back into work. So with Staffline, I met with the chief exec, a few weeks ago, and basically they use, like, I don't know, say it'll be Ocado or something. They partner with them a lot and get people back into work. They have some of Ocado's equipment and they're trained in these kind of units that are owned by Staffline to like learn how to use the equipment and things like that and then get them back into work.
Okay.
Staffline are like the biggest provider of the Welfare to Work program, and the contracts are actually all being retendered by the DWP next year. But I think Avanta and A4E were two Staffline acquisitions, and this is how they got into Welfare to Work. And it's unlikely that it'll be scrapped. So, you know, obviously we talk about political risk as being a big thing with outsourcing, but it is unlikely that it'll be scrapped because there's such a pressure now, obviously, to lower unemployment rates. And I think Staffline had something like a 20... 28% success rate of getting people back into work, which doesn't sound great, but I think the top company was actually G4S, who were about 30%.
Okay.
So they've done quite well in getting people back into work.
I mean, Staffline's not a big company.
No, they're not huge.
In the grand scheme of outsourcing, it's not of the scale of Capita or G4S. So you talked about the contracts coming up for retender. I mean, that must be a risk for some of the smaller companies competing in this space.
Well, yes, it will be. But I mean, that's the whole point why Staffline did the A4E acquisition. They've actually renamed it now because there are a lot of issues around fraud and things like that. And I thought the Ministry of the DWP actually said you have to rebrand it. That's what the chief exec said. They got told, we want you to rebrand this.
So fraud within the company that they bought.
But this was all, these are legacy issues.
Like retraining some of their own former employees.
These are legacy issues. Yeah. They've been renamed now, People Plus. But this is the point. Scale is the issue with outsourcers, which is why it's so hard if you are a small provider to kind of get in there.
Well, hasn't the government said that it wants more small providers to be providing these kind of services?
They've set targets. 25% of government contracts they want for small outsourcers to handle. But the fact is that to win a contract, you need a track record. So it's very difficult to kind of elbow your way in.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Especially if you're having to compete so aggressively on price with some of the bigger guys.
Yeah.
So do you think it's a realistic target the government has set, 25% by small companies?
No.
No.
Well,
damning.
Do you know what? It depends, actually, because I did speak to someone in the press office there, and they said that actually, okay, fair enough. Say, I don't know, a smaller outsourcer, they might not be the small company, but hopefully they'll integrate small companies somewhere along their supply chain. So maybe it'll come through there.
So it's subcontracting?
Yes.
Sounds like a fudge, doesn't it?
It does. Actually, well, talking about subcontracting, I know a lot of the big, and I'm talking about the big three, have been criticised in the past for subcontracting and kind of really squeezing little players in the market. So it's a bit of that in itself, to be honest, is controversial.
Indeed.
What about the international angle, which it used to be a big part of their growth strategy, but Serco under Rupert Soames has obviously rolled back from that massively. Has G4S...
They've really slimmed down because
Capita too.
It was just a mess, yeah. Capita not so much, but Serco have really slimmed down. Obviously, that the Indian business process
outsourcing
that one. They've sold that off, and they're concentrating a lot more on kind of UK and public sector, so you know, public sector is meant to be the whole driving force behind Serco's recovery. So hopefully,
but you obviously believe that
I do because I think they've hit the bottom. And they had that massive provision right back recently, which actually featured in the tip show, I think, last week.
Okay. This, by the way, is Algie Hall's new tip update show, where we go back and look at a tip and how it's performing. Yeah. So you did that last week.
Yeah. And that was just that they'd one of their kind of loss-making contracts. It was meant to end in 2022, and now it's 2017. It's going to end, so they've got rid of, rather than having to keep accounting for the loss, they've
refurbishing Australian gunboats or something?
It was the Armadale class of patrol boats that they were servicing.
And
that was loss-making for them, but they've cut back on that one.
Okay.
That was good.
I mean, defence is a big area for outsourcing. We won't go into it now because that bit was written by Daniel, who covers the aerospace and defence sector. So we won't go into that now. You have to pick up the magazine and read that aspect of the feature. I mean, one little company, I mean, you talk about, you know, how difficult it is for small companies to thrive in this space, despite the fact that the government wants them to. But there is a small company you've identified, which I must admit I'd never heard of before.
Essex-based as well.
Essex-based. Love a bit of Essex-based.
Yeah.
Lake House. Let's talk a bit about this.
Yeah, Lake House. No, I like Lake House. The CEO is actually used to work at Mears, one of their rivals.
Okay.
Basically, they started out, obviously, as this kind of Essex-based construction business.
Lots of them about, I tell you.
Exactly, yeah. But now they've gone into a lot more of the social housing sector. So obviously they get their money from local authorities, and the key to them is they're trying to make lots of kind of bolt-on acquisitions to, but say, you know, they have exposure to social housing maintenance in the south, so they'll make an acquisition up north. They're trying to just expand, and then they'll cross-sell their services, and they've shown really great growth actually so far.
Is it AIM traded, are they?
I think they may be main market.
Okay.
We've only just started covering them, actually, because they are quite small. They're over 100 million market cap, though.
Okay.
But they still are quite small. But actually, I think their yield, their estimated dividend for the full year will be 4.3%, which is pretty good.
Generating cash, which is what we'd like to see.
Yeah, they've got a great balance sheet, yeah, net cash. So yeah. I think they plan to carry on with their whole acquisitions, cross-selling agenda going forward.
It sounds sensible as long as they're managing that prudently, which I presume you're keeping a close eye on.
Oh yeah, cash is king.
Cash is king.
Can't
and, you
let
know,
the cash be eroded.
Don't want to overstretch the balance sheet.
Never.
Sounds good. Thank you, Emma. That's fascinating. So yeah, really interesting look at the outsourcing market and how that's developing. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, so that just about wraps up this week's podcast. There's plenty more in the magazine. We've got a momentum stock screen from Algy Hall. It's an absolute monster in terms of performance. The Sector Focus was written by you, wasn't it, Bradley?
It was, yeah. It's on...
On the buses.
Doesn't sound very sexy, but the buses, Bill.
On the buses, on yeah. The buses. And not necessarily going to be a very happy journey there for some of those companies.
Have a read.
Yeah. James Norrington has looked at what he describes as factor investing. So it's a play on smart beta, and he's got a couple of pieces in there around that as part of our market tactics series. Lots in the personal finance and funds section. They will be talking about that on their podcast, so you can have a listen to that and obviously have a read in the magazine. Lots of results, as we said. It's been a very busy week. Lots of comment, lots of news, which we haven't discussed on the podcast. Thank you, Bradley. Thank you, Emma, and thank you, Stephen. We'll be back again next week. In the meantime, go pick up the magazine, £4.50, all good news agents, and see you again soon. Thank you.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.